Bloomington normal residents have wondered what Rivian will do ever since the auto company first moved to the area. Recently, the startup unveiled plans to make electric pickup trucks. We'll speak to WGLT's Ryan Denham live from the LA Auto Show. Plus, students of all ages are using more technology in the classrooms than ever before, whether it's laptops, tablets, or other devices. Here's Ellen Wartella speaking at Northwestern University.
Preschool classrooms are adopting tablets quickly. We saw a doubling in 2 years. And the barriers to using technology are not access issues, but teachers' comfort, training, and parental expectations.
But first, we'll sit down with state climatologist Jim Angel to talk climate change. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, connected devices like Chromebooks and iPads are playing a bigger and bigger role in our classrooms. And we'll talk to two schools across Illinois, one that limits screens, another that actively uses them at all ages, to compare and contrast these educational approaches to screen time. Plus, earlier this week, General Motors announced layoffs of 15,000 workers at five North American factories. At the same time, this week, the electric car company Rivian unveiled its truck and SUV at the LA Auto Show. WGLT's Ryan Denham will join us live from the auto show at LA as we talk about the state of the industry as a whole. But first, you might have been busy shopping, enjoying time with family and friends after the Thanksgiving holiday, so maybe you missed a big report the government put out last Friday. It was the fourth climate assessment survey, and it painted a picture of changing climate that means not just bad news for farmers in the form of higher temperatures, higher risk of drought or floods, but for anyone who suffers from asthma or other respiratory problems. Here in the Midwest, temperatures are projected to rise more than any other region of the country. Jim Angel is the state's climatologist, and he wrote the Midwest chapter of the National Climate Assessment and is with me now in our Urbana studios. Hi, Jim. Welcome back to the 21st.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I should add to our audience, for those of you who have questions, I know a couple folks we actually got some emails about this morning. You're welcome to join in with any questions you have for Jim. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. It's a big report here. Jim, and I wanted to just start by asking you, this is a big report. Lots of scientists contributed to this. And climate change is a big problem that I think for many people, it seems insurmountable. And I think people have heard bits and pieces of this for a while, right? So I wonder, I know that there's not just one takeaway from all of this. I mentioned a couple of things at the beginning. I wonder if we should start, though, with the Midwest and temperatures. What are scientists saying about what we're thinking about temperatures in our part of the country?
That's right. If you look at the Midwest, so far we've actually been fairly lucky, I would say, in the Midwest. We have not seen the warm temperatures or the warmer temperatures that we've seen in places like the West Coast. But if you go farther north, we've actually already seen big impacts from warmer wintertime temperatures, especially in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan. Here in Illinois, it's been a little more moderate. But the big concern moving forward is the increased risk of the really high temperatures. So on average, we're expected to warm by about in the neighborhood of 4 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit by mid-century and much warmer than that by late century. But the big story is the impact on the extreme. So heat waves and really hot days are going to become more common, and that's very detrimental for crops and livestock and people, especially if you work outside. And so there will be lots of very negative impacts from those increases in the temperatures that are going to occur along with the increases in precipitation and heavy rainfall events.
And what time period are we talking about when we're seeing these changes? You mentioned we started to see some of this already. What are the projections in this? What time frame does this report cover, this climate assessment?
That's right. So we looked at two time periods, what we call mid-century and late century. And, now it's 2018, so we're really
actually,
not that far.
Actually, we're only like two decades from mid-century, right?
That's right, yeah. So we're not that far away from the mid-century mark. So we may see some pretty rapid increases in temperature moving forward in the next couple of decades.
And when you say a rapid increase in temperature, a really hot day, what is that? What are we talking about for Illinois? Does that mean more than 100 degrees?
Yeah, so I my personal threshold is about 95 degrees, but if you've got 95 degrees or 100 degrees, that's also a very important marker because that's when it's very hard on both animals and humans and corn and soybeans. So 100 degree days are fairly rare in Illinois right now. Southern Illinois maybe gets one or so per year. Here in central Illinois, it's a little less frequent. Northern Illinois rarely sees 100 degree weather, except if we're in a major drought, like in 2012. Those could become more common. So by mid-century, Chicago, instead of seeing no days, could actually see maybe 4 or 8 days of that. And by late century, it could be up to 22 or more. So it's a big change in our climate as we move forward.
And what does this mean for farmers? Because obviously, I think people can guess that more volatile weather, when we're talking about a drought or a flood, that's bad for crops. But what about the in-between? Because it's not just weather, it's really hot days, right? There are other impacts of this with changing climates for farmers?
That's right. So there are other impacts as well. Some of them are good and some of them are bad. So the good news is if as we get warmer, we'll have milder winters and warmer springs. And so that'll increase the growing season. So that's an upside, but it also means that we'll have more overwintering of pests like the Japanese beetle, my personal nemesis. And also greater increase in pathogens because they like warm, moist weather as well. So we'll have more trouble with those with crops. And so there are other stressors as well as we move forward. And I also would say that, you know, one of the biggest headaches we've seen up until now has actually been from very wet spring or fall conditions, you know, delaying the planting or delaying the harvest like it did this year. And so those things will also come into play, too. And sometimes those counteract any actions you might take. So for a strategy for hotter summer weather would be to plant earlier to beat the heat. But if it's wet in the spring, then you can't do that.
We're speaking with Jim Angel, who's a state climatologist and author of the Midwest chapter of the National Climate Assessment. It came out on Friday. Not great news for the Midwest, as we've been talking about. If you have questions for him, you can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet them as well. Our handle is 21STShow. So, Jim, when we're thinking about farming just in particular, and I just want to focus on this for just a minute more, just because I think people think, oh, this might affect farmers. It also affects our food production. So it affects all of us, whether or not we're in agriculture or not. The report says that agriculture, those in the ag sector, can adapt to climate change through planting decisions, as you were just talking about, farming practices and the use of technology. And the report includes ways farmers are already doing this.
That's right. One of the things we tried to highlight in this report are things that are already taking place to adapt to climate change. So we've got one of my favorites is a study out at Iowa State where they're using native plants in the waterways to reduce soil erosion and loss of nutrients on the field. And the results are actually pretty remarkable. Great reductions in both soil erosion and nutrient loss. Native plants also are good pollinators, so it's kind of a win-win situation. And, you know, native plants are actually very robust against climate change because they've had to deal with the climate of the Midwest already. So
by that, do you mean, are we talking about prairie grass?
Yes, prairie grass and other kind of perennials that we see that in natural areas in Illinois and elsewhere. So, yeah, they're very robust against most natural conditions. So they're a natural fit for this.
So actually planting back what was here before.
That's right,
essentially,
exactly.
Right? And yes. That it's interesting that so it's not all bad news in the report in terms of you all, you all made an effort to highlight ways people are already trying to change things.
Exactly. So same way with the urban areas. So we have green infrastructure, you know, those kind of things can reduce runoff and absorb the heavy rainfall events before they get into people's basements. So there's also steps you can take there as well.
Can we talk about what went into this report? It's 1,600 pages. There were 300 scientists, yourself included. How many folks from the Midwest contributed to this? And how did you go about gathering all of this data?
Yeah, so we had about a dozen authors for the Midwest chapter. I was the lead, so we had everybody pitched in, so an equal number. So it was a great team effort, and all these people had expertise in their areas. So some of them were foresters, some were ag people, and we also had people that are interested. We're experts in infrastructure and engineering and things like that. So we pulled together all the literature and all the published data that we could find on things that are going on in the Midwest. So this isn't new research. It's trying to summarize the state of the science of what's going on with climate change and how we adapt to it. So it's a kind of a great one-stop shopping. I probably will never read it cover to cover, but it's a good place to dig down in there and find some really good things about the Midwest and other parts of the country.
And so I wonder, when we think about what makes the Midwest unique, one of the biggest things is our Great Lakes. And I'm thinking about Lake Michigan in particular. What will we see with warming temperatures and its effect on Lake Michigan in particular, which has a huge effect on not just Chicago, but Wisconsin, folks on the other side of the lake as well, and that growing that happens in Michigan?
That's right. Yeah, the Great Lakes are a key feature of the Midwest. In fact, I'd say they're really the defining geographic feature of the Midwest and a great source of clean, fresh water. And the results are the expectations are that we're going to see more warming of the waters. In fact, we've already seen that. So the waters of the Great Lakes are getting warmer, and that has problems in its own right. If you're a cold water fish, that's bad news for you. It's maybe good news for more invasive species like the Asian carp. Also, we're going to have reduced ice cover in the wintertime, and so that could lead to more problems for shore erosion as the storms roll through. Although it is good news for shippers because that means a longer ice-free season. So there's always kind of winners and losers in this. But I would say the Great Lakes will also be impacted by more heavy rain events that cause more flushing of nutrients into the Great Lakes. That's been a really big problem in recent years. Especially Lake Erie has really struggled with, you know, you get
the algal blooms.
And yeah. Oh man, it's a mess. So that's going to be a real challenge moving forward.
So that we may continue to see that.
Yeah, unfortunately, yes.
And that's obviously our source of that's our largest source of fresh water, right?
That's right. That is, and a major source of drinking water in the Chicago area. So many of the Chicago proper and the suburbs use that.
When we're thinking about natural disasters, I think certainly we've heard a lot about the terrible wildfires in California, hurricanes last year and this year. In Illinois, when we're thinking about natural disasters and we're looking at changing climate, are you most concerned about floods?
I think the two biggest things on my list are floods and heat waves. So those are the ones that typically cause large loss of life as well as a large amount of economic damage. And so flooding is, and not just river flooding, but also flooding in, you know, people's basements, farm fields, and roadways and so forth. And we've really struggled with that. In fact, we did a 10-year study for Illinois, and we had about $2 billion in losses from flooding alone in the urban areas. So it's a big problem already, and it's already a big financial problem. And heat waves are especially damaging. Illinois and Chicago in particular is notorious for the 1995 heat wave, where over 700 people died. And we've had a couple since then where we also had loss of life. So those are very concerning. The other thing, too, is to keep in mind is that a lot of these things hit the poorer sectors of the population harder than anybody else. So, you know, the economic differences are pretty outstanding in that regard. And it's And that's going to be a concern moving forward, too, that getting enough services to these folks that they can actually weather these the climate extremes more easily.
So you mentioned $2 billion, a loss of $2 billion in terms of flooding in Illinois. The report points out that extreme weather has cost this country nearly $400 billion, and that's just since 2015. When we're thinking about that, I wonder if these are costs that you think state and local governments need to start budgeting for?
Yeah, and in fact, I think several of them have. I know in conversation with cities in Illinois is that they're already having to invest more in projects that manage stormwater. That's probably the biggest one. You know, here in Champaign-Urbana, we had the big Boneyard Creek project, and there's other cities that are having to address that as well. So that's probably one of the most tangible impacts that we've seen.
So during the election, Jim, I think we heard a lot from listeners who were concerned about climate change. I would say it was one of the biggest issues we heard from voters. And I wonder whether it's this report or the one from the UN earlier this year. I wonder if it's hard to not think about all of these awful things as inevitable. Do you see this, all of this, as inevitable?
Not really. So when the report, we actually looked at a couple of different scenarios. Actually, ironically enough, the worst case scenario was business as usual. In other words, if we don't do anything differently in the future, this is how bad it's going to get. If we look at doing things better and reducing our greenhouse gas emissions, the impacts are actually not as strong and not as severe as they are if we just keep doing what we're doing. So it's kind of like, you know, if you're a smoker, you know, the first thing you want to do is quit smoking. And it's kind of the same way with this. You know, that's you can make a big difference even if we just start now and reducing our greenhouse gases.
So we can improve things.
Exactly. We can make big improvements on the impacts in Illinois and elsewhere.
And is that what you want people to take away from this report? If people see this huge report, there's a lot of data, there's a lot of headlines that people have heard about this. For the individual person in Illinois listening, what do you think is important for them to focus on?
I think the big takeaways are that it is important. But it is significant problems in the future. But there is hope that if we do things differently, we'll come out with a different income than what was outlined in the report.
And when we say doing things differently, that's the individual level, that's at every level.
I think that's at every level. So individuals can make a difference, but also organizations and cities and states can also do their part as well.
That's Jim Angel. He is the state climatologist, the lead author of the Midwest chapter for the National Climate Assessment, which was released last Friday. We'll have more information about this at our website at 21stshow.org. It's a big report. If you want to read that, we will tweet out the link to it, as well as some other news coverage of it. Jim, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today, tens of millions of students use connected devices, whether we're talking about Chromebooks or iPads. Millions more use online apps. In fact, more than 30 million K-12 students use web apps like Google Docs or Gmail. That's according to The New York Times. So how do educators make sure that they're serving their purpose inside the classroom? Today, we're going to hear from two schools that approach this in very different ways. And later on, we'll be speaking with a researcher about what we know and don't know about the effects of technology in education. Adam Geisen is an instructional tech coach and longtime high school English teacher at Triad Community Unit 2 in Troy. That's in southern Illinois. They're about half an hour across the border from St. Louis. He helps train district teachers on how to use technology in the classroom. Carol Trajano currently teaches 7th grade humanities at the Waldorf School in Chicago, where they have no devices in the classroom until high school. Adam, Carol, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Nyla. Appreciate it.
Good morning to both of you. Adam, let's start with you. So you've got about 3,800 K-12 students in Triad Community Unit 2. What kind of devices are we talking about in classrooms, and at what grade level are you using these?
Well, we just started this year going fully one-to-one from grades 2 to grades 12. So we've got pretty much the entire district minus kindergarten and first grade is one-to-one with Chromebooks. So that's the big, the bulk of the devices that we have there. At the kindergarten and first grade level, we're kind of split. There are some Chromebooks, not full class sets, not fully one-to-one at first grade, but they're starting to get on them. And at kindergarten, we're using iPads and some Android tablets too. So it's kind of all a mix, but it's Google heavy.
And so one-to-one, does that mean every child has a device?
Every child has a device. And from sixth grade to high school, they take them home. So it's like it's assigned to them at the beginning of the year, and then they can use it, and then it's theirs until the end of their high school career, really.
And you've been a teacher for a long time, but now your job is to educate other teachers on how best to use technology in the classroom. I wonder if you can share with us some of the ways you think technology has helped students.
We're seeing, obviously, with technology, engagement is going to be the big improvement. This is the world that these kids are living in. The technology is a big part of their lives, and so in order for us to stay relevant, you know, we feel like school has to sort of reflect that. And so we're able to find the right applications, the right websites, the right tools that increase that engagement, but aren't necessarily just using technology for the sake of using technology. And it's our job. My cohort, Mike Wilgus, and I service the whole district, and we do our best to try to find these applications that improves engagement, but it also is really challenging students and making them, you know, become critical thinkers and become, real creatives in the classroom. And that's really our focus.
And do you worry that having this technology in the classroom all the time could make kids more easily distracted?
I don't think so. And we obviously use tools that we have some tools that we use to sort of monitor their use in the classroom while the class is actually happening. But really what we see and what we try to teach our teachers to do is to make the lessons so engaging that they are not necessarily tempted to become distracted. And when these kids are doing something that they're interested in, when they're doing something that really challenges them, we see that engagement grow and we see the distraction decrease. And so, like I said, it's really not so much for the technology. It's really more what the kids are doing that makes the technology beneficial.
That's Adam Geisen. He's an instructional tech coach for Triad Community Unit 2 in Troy, Illinois. We've also got Karen Trigono on the line with us from Chicago, where she teaches at the Waldorf School. Carol, what's your school's approach to technology in the classroom?
Well, we really have adopted what we call a slow approach. It's not a no approach, it's a slow approach. So what we took a long, hard look at what is the appropriate time, at what age, to sort of bring these tools to our students in a way that they will be able to master them. And we really feel that comes in the middle school when the child has, you know, is beginning to develop, you know, critical thinking, good judgment. And so we have adopted in sixth, seventh, and eighth grade a program called Cyber Civics. And this is about providing students with opportunities to talk about, you know, amongst their peers and with a teacher, two teachers actually, you know, how can I be an ethical, responsible citizen online? And even in that class, we don't actually have any computers in the classroom, but we simulate a lot of role-playing. We give a lot of problem-solving. The kids work together on different projects so that they can really, you know, begin to understand how you become a master of technology. And we really have put a huge emphasis in our classrooms from kindergarten, you know, through the grade school. The high school's different, but this huge emphasis on sort of human-to-human teaching. Teachers working with students in not just, sort of the typical academic approach, but also things with, like, how do you do art and how do you do handwork and how do you really develop these things that will grow your imagination and creativity. And so we really want to make an emphasis on, you know, how do we approach a whole bunch of different subjects, including in middle school technology, so that they can walk out with a sense of confidence that I'm not just dependent, you know, on this one thing. And also, I think we all understand that there's a can be a tendency with technology to really kind of become isolated. You know, you've got your headphones, you've got your screen, you're kind of in your own little world. And so we really want to work with students on how do you learn to work collaboratively with others? How do you learn to look somebody in the eye and say, you know, I've got a problem with this, or teacher, I don't understand this? And how does that relationship really develop an atmosphere where the kids can, you know, learn as much as they possibly can, not just about the subjects, but about, you know, how to be a human being in the real world?
Carol, you all are, the Waldorf School is obviously a private school. I wonder what your teacher-student ratios look like across your school in terms of how many teachers you have or how big your classroom sizes are.
Well, we have, our classroom sizes range from about 22 to 30. And I am a main class teacher, which means I'm responsible for a certain number of academic skills classes. But we also have a whole host of special subject teachers. So we teach Spanish and German. We teach handwork. We teach gym. We teach art. We teach woodwork. We teach movement. We teach music. You know, it comes down to like one teacher for 15 students if you count in all these special subject people. So they're really exposed to, you know, a large number of adults on any given day. And they go from subject to subject, you know, this sort of back and forth between, you know, things that might be more in an artistic realm, more in a practical arts realm, more in academic realm.
Adam, I wonder for you all, obviously you're a public school district. I mentioned how many students you have. What do your student-teacher ratios look like across the district?
It's really similar. We have, at the elementary levels, anywhere between 25 to 28. And then as you get up into high school, you can see classes as high as 30, but that's about where they cap. So it's very, very similar. You know, and again, same type of thing. While we do have technology as a tool, it's our focus is really to not necessarily use it sole as the only way of teaching, but as just an extra a way to get the content across and to have them practice. And, you know, it's not necessarily so much a taboo issue as it is here's how we could use it appropriately. And so that those types of things are being addressed as well, just like Carol said, we start a little earlier.
That's Adam Geisen from Troy, Illinois, and Triad Community Unit 2 schools. Carol Trigono is also with us. She teaches at the Waldorf School in Chicago. Both of them, of course, like all teachers, are concerned with the well-being of their students. And so is our next guest, Ellen Wartella. She's a professor and chair of Northwestern University's Department of Communication, and she directs their Center for Media and Human Development. Her research focuses on the effects of media and technology on kids. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Ellen, as you're hearing both Adam and Carol describe the two different approaches to technology in the classroom, as we're thinking about changing paces of just media and technology, and it's happening so fast, I wonder, do we know about how things like tablets or Chromebooks affect learning for kids?
Well, we have some data, some preliminary data, absolutely. We know that through a variety of mechanisms that, at least in small studies here and there, that the uses of the technology really depends on three things. It depends on the age of the child, and I was really pleased to hear both Carol and Adam talk about using technology or talking about technology in different ways with different age children, and middle schoolers are ready to talk about these sort of ethical questions that obviously kindergartners not. So we know that the effects of technology depends on the child. It depends on the content, and here it's quite clear that some content is better than other content for different age children, and to the extent that Adam is out searching for good apps and good content for children at different ages is really important. And when you think about the fact that there are 50,000 apps or something for kids, how do you find the good ones that will both be engaging and actually teach them something? And third, it's the context. And here, again, I was impressed to hear that the context is using technology as a tool so that, particularly for the younger children, they're scaffolding by adults who can help them negotiate and using the apps. And for older children, they can begin to use it in the context in which they understand how to approach the technology in both reasonable and ethical ways. The only other thing that I'd comment about is there's some disagreement in the literature about whether the one-to-one ratio of every child having an iPad, let's say, is appropriate for young children. There's some research that's been done out of my lab and other places that suggests that the younger grades, having children work in pairs is perhaps more effective way for them to negotiate the iPads or the technology in the classrooms. But clearly one-to-one technology, one iPad to each child has been popular in a lot of the school systems. And so we really have to see what effect it has over the long term in children's learning in this context. The only other thing I might add is that both Adam and Carol and schools around the country are acknowledging today that children are growing up in a technologized world, and it's a world that particularly the parents of today's young children are very comfortable in. And in the research that we've done, we did a national population survey about 3 years ago with the parents of children from birth to age 8, we found they're very eager to have their children embrace technology at young ages, especially fathers were eager about this, with the acknowledgement that growing up today, today's young people are going to be in a world that maybe even has more technology than we have today.
Ellen, I wanted to ask you about when we think about parents. One of the news articles that inspired this conversation was actually some reporting the New York Times did about how in Silicon Valley, some of the people who help make these devices, of people who work at Facebook or Google, they don't allow their children on them at all. And is it as simple as saying devices are good for learning and some aren't, no screen time? I wonder how, if it is really that simple.
Well, I think that what you have to do is you have to monitor it, and you can't have your child or your adult be on screen all the time. And so there are good rules going back to lots of other technologies that you limit the amount of time that you spend with the technology. You monitor how it's being used, and that monitoring is done differently for a kindergartner than for an adolescent. And you, to the extent that you can, you exclude technologies at certain places. I believe not at the dinner table. It shouldn't be an hour or so before going to bed, and certainly not in their room at night when they're going to bed, that there are ways of trying to teach and model appropriate uses of technology. The American Academy of Pediatrics has long said that screens should be limited to 2 hours a day or less. It gets harder once you think about screens today, particularly mobile phones and iPads being used for not just entertainment and playing games, but also for communication and for a whole host of connections. And so that kind of rough estimate of how much time kids could spend with screens is sometimes stretched on either end. Mm. But again, it depends on the age of the child, the content we're talking about, and the context. And the context includes monitoring and limiting the amount of time that they spend with it. But let's acknowledge that we live in a world of technology, and these children are growing up in that world, and we'll have to learn how to use technology in responsible ways.
Yeah, and to that point, to Ellen's point, that's Ellen Wartella with Northwestern University. Adam, Carol, I wonder if both of you could weigh in how much you think schools can model good behavior, or schools can provide a path for families to understand a little bit more about how they should be using technology with their children. Carol, let's start with your thoughts on that.
Well, our parents have actually come to us over the last several years and asked us, like, can we have some guidelines? What are your recommendations? So we've done a lot of research, and we actually have put something out to our parents about this slow approach. That, you know, what's appropriate for our kindergartners is going to be completely different for the kids that are in 7th and 8th grade. And they've been very, very appreciative of it because, like all of us, they're kind of overwhelmed, too. They don't want their kids getting hooked on technology. Sometimes it can be hard to set limits. And so we feel like we're working in a partnership to, you know, provide this opportunity to help them develop into healthy, you know, find these healthy pathways into technology, because it is a part of the world and we want to embrace it. It's just what's the right thing at the right time.
Adam, we just have a few minutes. Just I wonder briefly if you could answer that as well.
One of the ways we've addressed that is to bring coding really to the families. Coding is sort of the focus at the lower levels. We can do pretty simple block coding with some applications and some tablets that allow kids to really practice problem solving and creative thinking and that kind of thing at a really early age that gives them time and ways to do that. And we've had some evening some events where families can come in, kids can code together with their parents, so parents can see, here's the kind of stuff they're doing in school. It's not just watching YouTube videos, and we're not just, you know, playing simple games. We're actually creating things, and we're making things happen with our creative thinking and with our critical thinking in order to accomplish goals. And I think that, you know, when they see, when parents can see the stuff that we are doing at school and that it's not just just a screen that they're watching, they're creating things with it, then we can see real magic happen, and that's what's important.
Thanks for that. That's Adam Geisen with Triad Community Unit 2. I want to thank Carol Trigiono with the Chicago Waldorf School and Northwestern University's Ellen Martella. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 15,000 is the number of jobs that will be lost in the U.S. and Canada because of General Motors' decision this week to close down five of its plants. Car sales in general are also down, but right now, as all of this is happening, companies and manufacturers are in L.A. hoping to wow the public at the L.A. Auto Show. And one of those companies is Rivian. They're an electric car startup from Michigan. They've gotten some attention here in Illinois because they recently set up shop in Normal, where they plan to manufacture electric cars out of the former Mitsubishi plant in that community. This month, they unveiled their first vehicles, which will be an electric pickup truck and an SUV. We've heard about the SUV in the last 24 hours. Ryan Denham is a reporter with WGLT in Normal, and he's actually joining us live from the LA Auto Show, where he has been reporting on Rivian. Joe White is also on the line from Detroit, where he is the global automotive industry editor with Reuters. Gentlemen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Joe, let's start with you. Before we get to Rivian and to Illinois news, I wanted to start with these headlines about GM. Was this expected? So two of these plants that will be closed, completely closed, they were down to, I believe, one shift, right, are in Warren and Detroit, Michigan?
Yeah, I think that anyone watching the auto industry over the last couple of years, certainly within the last year, would have suspected that General Motors was going to have to do something about the overcapacity they have for building compact cars and mid-sized cars. I mean, sales of cars, as distinct from SUVs and trucks, pickup trucks, have just collapsed. And GM has a lot of car plants that have been operating well below their capacity. That said, you know, the timing and scope of this was a surprise to a lot of people, certainly to a lot of people in Washington, on both sides of the aisle, which could be problematic for GM. As I think many of your listeners are aware, the president has been very, very critical of GM over the last couple of days. So, yeah, and there certainly these were the biggest sort of one-day job cut announcement in the auto industry, U.S. auto industry, really since the financial crisis back
the
in 2008. 2009, mm-hmm. And the bailouts, exactly. Yeah.
So what does this say about the health of the auto industry? Is it different when it comes to American versus non-American owned companies? You've already made a distinction between cars and SUVs and trucks, Joe.
Well, I think the whole industry is challenged by the collapse of car sales, passenger car sales, and so that's a challenge for everyone. It's maybe more of a challenge for General Motors than it is for Honda, which has factories that are more flexible and are capable of switching more quickly to SUVs to a Honda CR-V from a Honda Civic. I do think, though, that the other thing that's going on here, and GM talked about this a lot, Mary Barra, the CEO, talked about this a lot, is that the automakers are looking ahead to a pretty profound revolution in the way cars are built and the way they're powered. More electric vehicles, fewer vehicles powered by gasoline or diesel internal combustion engines. And as they look to that future, they are starting to ask themselves, look, you know, what are our products going to look like, and what are our workforces going to look like as we engineer and build those vehicles? And particularly on the engineering side, GM is going to be cutting roughly 8,000 engineering jobs. A lot of that has to do with looking at a staff of people who are, you know, built for an internal combustion world, and asking how do we get people who have the skills we need for cars that are essentially software electric devices.
Ryan, at the LA Auto Show, I wonder what the mood and atmosphere is like and how much this news of GM, and as Joe started talking about how much this is reflective of changes in the industry, has this at all affected the mood of the show, which is, I know, supposed to be very boostery. Everybody's very excited normally at these shows.
Yes, to some degree. So on Monday when this news broke, that was the day that that Rivian was launching its pickup truck, right? So at their launch event, it was certainly a topic. You go up to somebody and bring up Rivian, and the conversation would turn to the GM announcement. No, but I think he's dead on in terms of this show is very much positioned at sort of the intersection of, you know, changes in mobility and electrification of cars and connectivity of cars. Like Rivian, which is this company that is going to be building cars in Illinois, is certainly trying to get ahead of this car ownership collapse. They are going to be selling their pickup and SUV initially, but after 5 years, they said they expect their revenue model to flip and to be more based on subscriptions and people renting them maybe for the weekend, calling one up and having it drive itself to your house to pick you up for the weekend, that kind of thing. But, you know, to some degree, though, I think the show does feel a little disconnected. You know, you hear so much about these cars, but nobody's talking about the jobs that will be created or not created if they come to fruition. That's certainly not the conversation.
Yeah, and I wonder, Joe, as we're thinking about this transition, I saw a report that Tesla might buy one of the GM plants that are shuttered. Certainly, Rivian moved into a former Mitsubishi plant in Normal. Do you think we'll see more electric car companies moving in, taking over from traditional car companies? And I'm thinking, I wonder if the hiring will also, if we're thinking about engineers, if those skills will also be transferable.
Yeah, so I'm not sure about the Tesla buying buying a GM plant. I see a little bit of speculation about that. That would certainly be interesting. I mean, they're already the plant they have was a former essentially a former GM plant many years ago. So that, who knows? They need more capacity. So yes, I mean, as electric vehicles grow, the question will be how much of that growth is captured by new companies like Tesla or Rivian, and how much of it is captured by legacy companies like GM or Ford or Toyota that basically start building electric vehicles of their own. And I think that's a competition that we're going to see play out over a number of years as we go forward. This won't happen all overnight. In terms of the engineering talent, that fight is absolutely happening as we speak. People who could go to work for Ford or GM, or for that matter for the U.S. operations of Toyota or Nissan, have a choice to go to work for Rivian or Tesla or any number of several companies that are in that space. And the fact that the capital markets and venture investors are willing to put money into companies like Rivian, it shows you that there's a real belief that that the legacy companies don't necessarily own the future. So I think it's going to be very competitive. It's not all going to work out for companies like Rivian. I don't know what Rivian's future is, but they're up against companies that have a heck of a lot of capital and a heck of a lot of intellectual ability to design vehicles. Question is whether they can outmaneuver them and survive in the long term.
That's Joe White, who's the global automotive industry editor with Reuters, based in Detroit. Ryan Denham is on the line with us from the LA Auto Show. Ryan, so let's get to the future and to these vehicles that we finally have seen now, both a truck and an SUV. What do they look like?
Well, yeah, you know, this is me too. I'm not really a car guy, so I'm coming from this as sort of a layman, like the public. They're pretty striking. The pickup truck looks, I mean, the front of it with these kind of vertical headlights, it looks very futuristic. Looks like something out of Tron, but like in a good way. The SUV is kind of looks like a fancy Range Rover, a fancier Range Rover. And the specs are fairly impressive sounding. I mean, the batteries are huge relative to other EVs on the market. The range of over 400 miles is larger than most everything on the market. But there's some cool little stuff too. Like there's this there's like a gear tunnel which is kind of sits behind the seats in the pickup truck, and it stretches from side to side. So you could stick like a golf clubs or a little boogie board or something through it.
Okay, I thought you meant it was for like plugging in devices, but you mean it's for actual gear. Okay.
actual gear. Yeah, their whole brand is like this adventure lifestyle thing. So, yeah,
and how much are these going to cost, Ryan?
Yeah, they're a little pricey. The SUV will start at $72,000, and the pickup at $69,000. The premium versions of those, though, with like the biggest battery pack, those will go on sale first or into production first, and those could be like $90,000. So that's like, that's Range Rover price. That's Tesla price. That's not like a cheap Ford F-150.
Yeah, Joe, what do we think about that price point? And I wonder if, I don't know if Tesla is a model for this or not.
Well, it's really high. Ryan is absolutely right. I mean, that's really high. I mean, that's a luxury. It's obviously, it's a luxury good. And that's, so look, one of a number of things that Elon Musk has gotten right about electric vehicles compared to the legacy companies, which for years tried to position electric vehicles as kind of science projects for people who hate cars. Elon Musk and the designers and engineers he hired said, no, an electric car can be a premium luxury vehicle that people aspire to own because it says something, you know, about them. And they've done, I would say, pretty well with that, except that they've struggled to make money up until the last quarter, where they finally turned a profit. And going forward, that's going to be their challenge, is turning a profit. I mean, these Rivian trucks are as expensive as they are because they're expensive. The Detroit companies make margins, you know, well above 10% on it. Probably closer to 20% or more on their pickup trucks. They're cash cows. So the question is whether companies like Rivian can hang in as the Detroit companies counter and say, look, we're going to subsidize our electric trucks with our trucks that burn gasoline or diesel and make tons and tons of money. And that's a fight that will play out over a number of years. And you know, for Rivian, I think it's going to be difficult to sell trucks at that price at anything like a high volume. I think it's going to be very much a specialty luxury good that they have to work hard to work the price down, or the work the cost down rather, so that they can start making money and fund their next generation of product.
And as I wanted to end this conversation as we started with jobs, and Ryan, ask you about the jobs for Normal. The mayor of Normal is at the LA Auto Show, right? And I know this is a big deal as far as the plant. What has Rivian said about what kind of jobs they will be offering, employment they'll be offering for the community? Ryan?
Sorry.
Oh, looks like we've lost Ryan there. Some little technical stuff. Joe, let me just end by then asking you just about the viability of, as you were saying, this is going to be, if it is a specialty, if we're thinking about Rivian being a specialty car, a luxury car, that's going to, by nature of it, sounds like going to be a pretty smaller, then it's not going to be like a mass production of like a GM or a Toyota or something like
certainly
that.
Certainly not. Yeah, certainly not initially. And again, I think that, you know, the history of the auto industry is one of where you'll have, where, you know, this, when I say history, I mean it. I mean, going back a century, you know, early in the 20th century, as the auto industry was developing, you had scores of companies building all kinds of cars all over the United States. And then it kind of collapsed down to essentially the Detroit Three. And then the European and Asian automakers came in and built plants and kind of, you know, moved it back up again. You know, if I had to bet, I'd say we're going to see the same thing as electric vehicles and a new technology gain ground. We're going to see a bunch of startups like Tesla and Rivian and many more try to launch. Some of them are going to make it and some of them aren't. And honestly, I have no idea how that's going to play out. But I think that's what you're seeing. You're seeing investors and entrepreneurs like the folks behind Rivian saying, look, you know, you get a once in a century chance to catch the wave of really profound technology and market change. We're going to give it a shot. And that's what they're doing. And it'll be really fascinating to see how it plays out. And, you know, hopefully the people in Illinois will be pleasantly will reap a reward from that. But it's not guaranteed.
That's Joe White. He's the global automotive industry editor with Reuters based in Detroit. I want to thank WGLT's Ryan Denham for being with us from the LA Auto Show. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Anytime. Sure.
Finally, before we go, a week ago, last Monday, you may have heard the news about a shooting at Mercy Hospital in Chicago. A gunman shot and killed three people, a pharmacist, an ER doctor, and a Chicago police officer, and he eventually killed himself after a standoff with SWAT officers. This morning, U.S. Senator Dick Durbin took some time on the Senate floor to remember the lives that were lost.
Officer Jimenez, Dr. O'Neill, Ms. Liss were all doing work that mattered, and mattered greatly. All three were dedicated to helping others. Officer Jimenez as a protector, Dr. O'Neill and Ms. Liss as healers. Their deaths have left their friends and families, the Chicago Police Department, and all of the city of Chicago stunned and grieving. There is never, never a good time to lose a family member to violence, but to lose them in a holiday season seems especially cruel. Our hearts go out to Officer Jimenez's family and to the O'Neill and Liss families.
Audio was first from Senator Durbin's YouTube channel. Senator Durbin then called for gun control laws to make sure that this doesn't happen again. That does it for us today. Tomorrow on the 21st, a new stage project called No Blue Memories brings the work of Gwendolyn Brooks to life. It was written in Chicago, and it's actually coming to Central Illinois to the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts on Thursday evening. We'll be speaking to some of the actors involved with that. Our website is always a great way to get a hold of us. It's 21stshow.org. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.